From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Chicago.
Yesterday and today, agents of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, working with the U.S. Attorney's Office and other authorities, executed the largest single worksite enforcement operation against the company in American history. In fact, we arrested more people in this single worksite enforcement operation than in the entirety of last year.
Immigration crackdown. Homeland Security rounds up 1,200 undocumented workers in 26 states. We'll take a look at the unprecedented immigration raids and the ongoing struggle for immigrant rights. Then author Stephen Kinzer on Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq.
Many Americans and many people around the world looked at the American invasion of Iraq as the moment when the U.S. was ripped away from a long tradition of cooperative diplomacy and thrown into a new age when we violently overthrew foreign governments. What I'm saying in my book is that's not true. This invasion is only the latest in a long series of American overthrows of foreign governments that stretch back over more than 100 years.
And we'll take a look at an election race in New Orleans that's considered the city's most important mayoral race ever. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In what's being called one of the largest immigration crackdowns in recent U.S. history, 1,200 undocumented workers from 26 different states were rounded up and detained late Wednesday. The raids focused on the Houston-based company IFCO Systems North America. Seven current and former managers were charged with conspiracy to transport, harbor, and encourage illegal immigrants to reside in the U.S. for commercial and financial gain. The managers face up to 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine for each undocumented worker. The arrests come on the heels of the massive rallies in support of immigration rights that have taken place in the last month. We'll have more on this story after headlines. In Nepal, 100,000 people poured into the streets Thursday in defiance of a government warning they could be shot on sight for violating a curfew. The demonstrations marked the largest show of opposition to the rule of King Gyanendra since the outbreak of pro-democracy protests more than 2 weeks ago. More than 2,000 people staged a sit-in at the site of a police shooting that killed three people and injured dozens more. In Washington, President Bush welcomed Chinese President Hu Jintao for their first White House summit. During a joint media address, Bush made a brief mention of civil liberties in China.
I'll continue to discuss with President Hu the importance of respecting human rights and freedoms of the Chinese people. China has become successful because the Chinese people are experienced the freedom to buy and to sell and to produce. And China can grow even more successful by allowing the Chinese people the freedom to assemble, to speak freely, and to worship.
Who followed President Bush's remarks but was interrupted by a protester as he began his speech. The protester, Wen Yiwang, denounced the Chinese government's treatment of practitioners of the spiritual movement Falun Gong. Wang yelled, quote, President Bush, stop him from killing, stop him from persecuting the Falun Gong. Wang was grabbed by Secret Service officers and led away. President Bush then encouraged Hu to proceed with his remarks, telling him, quote, you're okay. Administration official later said the President Bush apologized to Hu for the protesters' interruption. Although the incident made headlines around the world, it failed to reach a mass audience in China. According to CNN, the Chinese government censored the portion of its broadcast that showed the incident taking place. In Israel, the government imposed travel ban on nuclear whistleblower and peace activist Mordechai Vanunu has been extended for another year. Israeli authorities say Vanunu must remain inside the country because he's still seen as a security risk to the state. Vanunu was released from prison in 2004 after serving an 18-year sentence for leaking secrets about Israel's nuclear program. In Mexico, hundreds of police raided a steel plant occupied by striking workers Thursday. Two workers were killed, another 36 were injured. In other news, the UN's top humanitarian official is warning Relief efforts in Sudan's Darfur region are facing a serious risk of collapse. The official, Jan Eglin, said aid workers will be unable to meet local needs unless foreign donors contribute more funding and the Sudanese government eases restrictions on aid workers. According to Eglin, the international community has provided just 20% of pledged donations. Eglin added, 200,000 people are currently not receiving the food aid they need to survive, while 650,000 people are now completely beyond the reach of aid workers. In Ontario, Canada, a major standoff at a Native site intensified Thursday when police used taser guns and tear gas to disrupt a protest. Native protesters have occupied the site for the last 7 weeks in an attempt to prevent construction of a housing development on what they say is their ancestral land. 16 people were arrested in the raid. Within hours, the site was reoccupied by a group of over 200 Native protesters who'd come to provide their support. Back in the United States, a new poll shows President Bush's approval rating is at a record low. According to Fox News, just 33% of Americans say they approve of the president's performance. Meanwhile, a new Bloomberg Los Angeles Times poll has found 58% of Americans believe the war in Iraq was unnecessary. In other news, a new report from the Congressional Research Service says the U.S. is now spending close to $10 billion a month on the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, an increase of nearly $8 billion from 1 year ago. In Virginia, testimony in the trial of 9/11 suspect Zacharias Moussaoui concluded Thursday. In a statement read before the court, two FBI analysts said they highly doubted Moussaoui's claim that he and Richard Reed were meant to have flown a fifth plane into the White House. Closing arguments in the case are expected Monday. The jury will then decide if Moussaoui is to be sentenced to death or to life in prison. And this update on a story we've been following: in New Mexico, Albuquerque's Veterans Affairs Medical Center has publicly admitted it wrongly accused one of its nurses of sedition. In September, the nurse, Laura Berg, wrote a letter to a local newspaper criticizing the Bush administration around its dealing with Hurricane Katrina and the Iraq War. Her employers responded by confiscating her computer shortly after she was informed she was being investigated. Up until this week, the hospital had given Berg a private apology, but had resisted calls to publicly admit its allegations were false. And the late Reverend William Sloan Coffin, Jr., was remembered Thursday at a funeral service at New York's Riverside Church. For the past half century, Coffin was a leading anti-war and civil rights advocate. Veteran journalist Bill Moyers was among those who spoke about Coffin's life.
He believed the long and great struggle of America was the struggle to assure that the rewards of a free society went to everyone and not just to the top. That last time we talked, he said how much he liked the story that he had heard Joseph Campbell tell me on our series, The Power of Myth. The story of the fellow who turns the corner and sees a brawl in the middle of the block. He runs right for it, shouting, "Is this a private fight or can anybody get in it?" Bill saw democracy as everyone's fight. He'd be in the middle of the fork right now, his coat off, his sleeves rolled up, his hand raised, pointing us to the action. And his message would be the same as it was then. Sign up. Jump in. Fight on.
That was Bill Moyer speaking at the funeral service for the late Reverend William Sloan Coffin in New York. He died last week at the age of 81. And those are some of the headlines.
Río, lloro, callo, grito, porque no me quieres. que había escuchado la promesa que aquí yo encontraría la manera para poder vivir mejor.
Siento, río, lloro, callo, grito por toda mi gente. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito porque no me entiende. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito por toda mi gente. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito porque no me entiende.
No quiero que entienda que mi camino corre el sudor, que yo quiera mi tierra, que a mí también me duele lo mismo que a usted. De aquí como lo es cualquiera, que también me da pena las injusticias, la pobreza de mí.
Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito por toda mi gente. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito porque no me entiende. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo, grito por toda mi gente. Sufro, siento, río, lloro, callo.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Chicago, Illinois, as we turn to the ongoing struggle around immigration rights in this country. On Wednesday evening, immigration authorities rounded up almost 1,200 undocumented immigrants in 26 states in what law enforcement officials say was the culmination of a year-long criminal investigation. The authorities raided the offices and plants of the company IFCO Systems North America, which is based in Houston, Texas, and makes wooden pallets and crates. Among those arrested were seven current and former managers who were charged with conspiracy to transport, harbor, and encourage illegal immigrants to reside in the United States for commercial and financial gain. The managers face up to 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine for each undocumented worker. Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff made the announcement of the arrests yesterday morning.
Yesterday and today, agents of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, working with the U.S. Attorney's Office and other authorities, executed the largest single worksite enforcement operation against the company in American history. In fact, we arrested more people in this single worksite enforcement operation than in the entirety of last year. This was an investigation which began over a year ago, and yesterday we arrested 1,187 people on administrative immigration charges, and seven criminal complaints were brought against managers or former managers for alleged criminal violations in connection with the hiring of illegal undocumented aliens.
The arrests come on the heels of the massive rallies in support of immigration rights that have taken place in the last month. The rallies are a response to proposed federal legislation that would turn millions of undocumented immigrants into criminals, would fence off sections of the U.S. border with Mexico. In Chicago, which held some of the earliest protests, it's estimated that up to 60 people were arrested last night in the raids and were held at the Broadview Detention Facility in Chicago's southwest side. I'm joined right here in Chicago by Jorge Muica. He was one of the main organizers of the Chicago protests last month. He also a journalist and union organizer in both the U.S. and Mexico. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Can you respond to this roundup that has taken place?
Yeah, in two ways. We believe that this is the worst moment to be launching such an operation. If Chertoff says they had, you know, been preparing for this for as long as 1 year, then why now? Why not to wait for 3 weeks or 2 weeks even or 1 month, yeah, until Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives come up with an integral immigration reform plan? Many of these people that were rounded up, arrested, and some of them deported might have been legalized in 2 weeks or in 3 weeks, or be eligible to be legalized. So why now? It was a total surprise for us. You know, it seems ridiculous to do it right now.
Well, what do you think? What do you think is
it? I think it was a message. I think it was a message for us. It's incredible when you read the declarations of Chertoff. He uses time and over the word criminal, criminal, criminal alien, you know, and he insists that this is an operation to remove criminal aliens from the United States. The wording seems appropriated to the Sensenbrenner legislation, which is the legislation that would turn 12 million people into criminals. But that doesn't exist yet. You know, we are not criminals according to the law. To cross the border without papers is an administrative fault. It's not a crime, legally. So why is Chertoff using the word criminal time and over? It's a message for us, I think.
And what are you going to do about it?
Oh, this backfired on him. If that was the intention, to intimidate people, it backfired on him. Over the radio in Spanish language, over the printed media, everybody's so outraged at this operation that people that were not marching with us, that were not organizing with us, are now doing it. We are preparing the next demonstration for May Day, Monday, and we were expecting to have 300,000 people. Now we expect to have 500,000.
Now, yours was the first major protest of this wave of protests that are not only the largest immigration protests in the history of this country. They're the largest protests on any issue
ever
in the history of
ever
this country. And Chicago began it. How many people marched in the streets?
Well, according to the superintendent of police, Phil Klein, he said it was 300,000. Nevertheless, the official declaration by the Chicago Police Department only said it was 100,000. It doesn't matter much. We consider this one the second largest demonstration in Chicago, right after the 1886 demonstrations by the people that brought us the weekend and the 8-hour workday. You know, the Chicago martyrs, the guys that created May Day.
Explain that.
Yeah, in 1886, a lot of immigrants, hundreds of thousands of immigrants, took the streets of Chicago, went out on a strike, seeking a reduced day workday, only 8 hours. That was the birth of the 8-hour, as we know it today, as the 8-hour workday. In 1886, there were many protests. There were confrontations with the police, riots, even a bomb. Some policemen were killed. And out of all of that, the labor unions were born. And this was basically an immigrants' struggle. At the time, it was German immigrants, Russian immigrants, Italian immigrants, British immigrants. Yeah, but we are coming, you know, around full circle. 120 years later, immigrants in this country are fighting again for working conditions. To have papers or not have papers, it's a working problem. It's not only an immigration problem. It's regarding how do you work, where do you work, in which conditions do you work. So we are commemorating May Day, I guess, in full form.
Can you tell us what this company is that the immigration raids were targeted at, what your understanding of IFCO Systems North America is that's based in Houston, Texas?
They create pallets. You know, it's a very low-paid job. It's the kind of job when President George Bush said, you know, 2 years ago that immigrants take jobs the U.S. citizens are not willing to take. He was talking about this kind of jobs, dirty, heavy, and very badly paid. Apparently, for what we understand, executives, the company itself, was encouraging workers, was seeking workers, you know, in other countries, not only Mexico, but in other countries, encouraging them to come here and work for their company. This is a problem. The United States requires you to have certain papers in order to work here legally, but at the same time, it refuses to give you those papers. The United States economy is creating 500,000 jobs a year, and is not producing 500,000 U.S. citizens to fill up those jobs. So, okay, you want me to present papers? Give me the papers before I cross the border. It's as easy as that.
We're talking to Jorge Mojica, who is a former journalist, worked for La Raza, Univision, Telemundo, is a union organizer. May 1st, you said the next round of major protests. Do you support the boycott that a number of immigrant rights activists are advocating for that day, the idea of a day without an immigrant?
No, actually, we don't. And it might be a matter of wording the action. When we invite people to march with us, we obviously are inviting people not to work that day or not to go to school. And anyone marching is not going to be buying anything, is not going to be selling anything. Economically, you have the same effect. But we are not calling for a boycott for a simple reason. We brought the labor unions on board as our allies because we want to take away the only immigration and only immigrants aspect of this struggle. This is a working problem. If we bring the labor unions on board, then they cannot, even, you know, by far, touch the word boycott because that's illegal for labor unions to do. And so we put things in a balance and we decided, okay, do we talk about a boycott or we bring the labor unions to our side? And we decided definitely we want the labor unions. So forget the boycott. The economic impact is going to be there anyway, but we are not calling for a boycott.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We will certainly continue to follow this debate, struggle, protest. We've been speaking with Jorge Mujica, who is a former journalist, who is a union organizer, one of the major organizers of the March 10th protests here in Chicago. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Well, you've been talking to the people, trying to get them to go your way. Telling us not to worry, you say. It's just one issue. What about the rest of it, Mr. Stick? Well, if you've got the plan, all I say to you, if you've got the master plan, I got the vote for you. Oh yeah, I got the vote for you. This country needs is a lady president. Oh, we don't want
it. Marvin Gaye, you're the man, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Saturday, New Orleans will hold a primary for what's being considered the city's most important mayoral race ever. Protests surrounding the vote have been taking place for months. Voting rights activists fear tens of thousands of Hurricane Katrina evacuees living out of state will be unable to vote. Efforts were made to set up satellite voting locations in cities like Houston or Atlanta, but a federal judge rejected the idea. Evacuees living out of state have been given two options: attempt to vote by absentee ballot or spend hours driving to a polling location inside Louisiana. Well, 2 weeks ago, Democracy Now! Went to New Orleans, and we caught up with Mayor Ray Nagin, as well as one of his chief opponents, Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu. Landrieu is the brother of U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu and the son of Moon Landrieu, the city's last white mayor. I asked Mayor Nagin about his concerns that the vast majority of African-American evacuees from New Orleans may not be able to vote in the upcoming mayoral election.
Well, I've always been concerned about that. That's why I've been talking with the Secretary of State to try and make it as easy as possible. Right now, if they're not going to absentee vote or come to the city, they're really going to have a tough time.
And that issue of Iraqis being able to vote by satellite but not here for New Orleans residents outside of New Orleans?
It's really a shame, that this is happening in the United States. We have the technology. We could have done this much better and much easier for all of our citizens. You know, considering all that we went through and the levees broke, if it wasn't for the levees, our folks wouldn't be dispersed. The government should have moved and made it as convenient. Nobody should have to leave where they are to vote, and it's a shame.
You said hurricane season is almost upon us. Have the levees been strengthened to deal with a kind of hurricane like Katrina, a hurricane?
They look like they're going to be okay by the time June 1st gets here. I've been inspecting the levees, meeting with the Corps of Engineers, and they're doing the base level work that if another Katrina came through, we wouldn't have the catastrophic flood.
Are you saying that Hurricane 5, these levees could deal with?
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. Another Katrina-like storm. Hurricane 5 is a whole different matter. That requires restoring our wetlands, armoring the levees. There's a whole lot more that needs to be done.
And why can't that be done now, immediately?
It's a matter of money, and the Congress has not authorized that yet.
Who's been in the way of that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm up there lobbying as much as I can. We took them from $1 billion to now they have $3 billion, and now they're asking for $6 billion. So it looks like it's an incremental process.
That was New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin. Earlier this week, the Army Corps of Engineers announced the levees had been restored to pre-Katrina strength, but the Corps admitted that armoring of the levees probably won't take place until the end of the hurricane season. While in New Orleans, I also caught up with Nagin's chief opponent, Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu. We spoke outside the historic African-American Catholic Church, St. Augustine.
Do you think New Orleans will ever become a majority black city again?
It is now.
It doesn't look that way.
Well, it depends on what neighborhood you go in. You must not be going into all the neighborhoods. But this city, and I'm going to try to explain this to the national media one more time. This city has never been all black and never been all white. The beauty of this city is that's everything to everybody. From the beginning of time, before the United States became a union, we had so many different kinds of people down here, and the entire culture arises out of that. That's why you feel something different when you come down here than what you see in New York or what you see in Los Angeles or Chicago. We have so many different kinds of people that we're all a melting pot. That's what we call jumbo. And so, I mean, it really is this attitude of getting along. Our multicultural side of us, our diversity is our strength. It's not our weakness. And we really work hard not to be separated the way the national media wants to try to separate us.
But the majority of the poorest black residents have not been able to return.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, the poor always get hurt. General Honoré said this the best, that when it's cold, the poor are colder. You know, when it's hot, the poor are hotter. So it's an issue of poverty and it's an issue of race. It's an issue of both. The white people here that were poor that got hurt very badly, African Americans did too. So the issue really is not as much about race as it is about poverty. They're not the same thing. Sometimes they coincide. As a nation, we need to figure out the difference between the two, and we need to address both of them.
And how are you going to get them back to New Orleans?
Well, again, you were at the forum yesterday. I mean, the whole point is to try to get the city up and operating as quickly as possible and welcome everybody back. But it's housing, it's schools, it's education, it's health care. Nothing can happen fast. The city is really hurt very badly. You can't wave a magic wand and turn it back into what it was before Katrina. So we're all going to have to struggle through this together. Today is an example how you can find higher crime ground. We made a success out of something that was really tough. So if we keep working together like we have with something like this particular issue, maybe we can get there.
That was New Orleans mayoral candidate, Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu. I interviewed him outside of St. Augustine shortly after a mass marking the reopening of the oldest African-American church in the country. The Archdiocese of New Orleans recently attempted to close the parish but was forced to reverse its decision following protests and a sit-in inside the church's rectory. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, public access TV and PBS stations, low-power FM and college and community radio stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. We're broadcasting today from Chicago, and today we take on the issue of America's century of regime change from Hawaii to Iraq, a new book. It's called Overthrow. We spend the remainder of the hour on this issue of American foreign policy. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 was not an isolated episode. It was the culmination of a 110-year period during which Americans overthrew 14 governments that displeased them for various ideological, political, and economic reasons. So writes author Stephen Kinzer in his new book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Kinzer writes that, quote, the regime change in Iraq seemed for a time, a very short time, to have worked. It's now clear, however, that this operation has had terrible unintended consequences. So have most of the other coups, revolutions, and invasions that the United States has mounted to depose governments it feared or mistrusted. Stephen Kinzer joins us today in Chicago. He is a veteran New York Times foreign correspondent, author of several books, including All the Shah's Men and Bitter Fruit. He's just recently left the New York Times. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
It's great to be with you, Amy.
It's good to be in your city, Stephen.
Love it.
Well, you are looking at 14 coups that the U.S. was involved with. What was the primary reason for the U.S. government's involvement in overthrowing other countries' governments?
A lot of these coups have been studied individually, but what I'm trying to do in my book is see them not as a series of isolated incidents, but rather as one long continuum. And by looking at them that way, I am able to tease out certain patterns that recur over and over again. They don't all fit the same pattern, but it's amazing how many of them do. You ask about the motivations, and that is one of the patterns that comes through when you look at these things all together. There's really a three-stage motivation that I can see when I watch so many of the developments of these coups. The first thing that happens is that the regime in question starts bothering some American company. They start demanding that the company pay taxes or that it observe labor laws or environmental laws. Sometimes that company is nationalized or is somehow required to sell some of its land or its assets. So the first thing that happens is that an American or foreign corporation is active in another country, and the government of that country starts to restrict it in some way or give it some trouble, restrict its ability to operate freely. Then the leaders of that company come to the political leadership of the United States to complain about the regime in that country. In the political process, in the White House, the motivation morphs a little bit. The U.S. government does not intervene directly to defend the rights of a company, but they transform the motivation from an economic one into a political or geostrategic one. They make the assumption that any regime that would bother an American company or harass an American company must be anti-American, repressive, dictatorial, and probably the tool of some foreign power or interest that wants to undermine the United States. So the motivation transforms from an economic to a political one, although the actual basis for it never changes. Then it morphs one more time when the U.S. leaders have to explain the motivation for this operation to the American people. Then they do not use either the economic or the political motivation, usually, but they portray these interventions as liberation operations, just a chance to free a poor, oppressed nation from the brutality of a regime that we assume is a dictatorship, because what other kind of a regime would be bothering an American company?
Stephen Kinzer, I want to begin where you do in the book, and that is with Hawaii.
Many Americans, I don't think, realize that Hawaii was an independent country before it was brought into the United States. In brief, this is the story. In the early part of the 19th century, several hundred American missionaries, most of them from New England, sailed off to what were then called the Sandwich Islands to devote their lives to, as they would have put it, raising up the heathen savages and teaching them the blessings of Christian civilization. It wasn't long before many of these missionaries and their sons began to realize that there was a lot of money to be made in Hawaii. The natives had been growing sugar for a long time, but they had never refined it and had never exported it. By dispossessing the natives of most of their land, a group that came from what was then called this missionary planter elite sort of left the path of God, went on to the path of mammon, and established a series of giant sugar plantations in Hawaii. And they became very rich from exporting sugar into the United States. In the early 1890s, the U.S. passed a tariff that made it impossible for the Hawaiian sugar growers to sell their sugar in the U.S. So they were in a panic. They were about to lose their fortunes. And they asked themselves what they could do to somehow continue to sell their sugar in the U.S. They came up with a perfect answer. We'll get into the U.S. How will we do this? Well, the leader of the Hawaiian revolutionaries, if you want to call them that, who are mostly of American origin, actually went to Washington. He met with the Secretary of the Navy. He presented his case directly to the President of the United States, Benjamin Harrison, and he received assurances that the U.S. would support a rebellion against the Hawaiian monarchy. So he went back to Hawaii and became part of a triumvirate, which essentially carried out the Hawaiian Revolution. He was one part of the triumvirate. The second part was the American ambassador, who was himself an annexationist and had been instructed by the State Department to do whatever he could to aid this revolution. And the third figure was the commander of the U.S. naval vessel, which was conveniently anchored right off the shores of Honolulu. This revolution was carried out with amazing ease. The leader of the Hawaiian revolutionaries, this missionary planter elite, simply announced at a meeting one day, "We have overthrown the government of Hawaii, and we are now the new government." And before the Queen was able to respond, the U.S. ambassador had 250 Marines called ashore from the ship that was conveniently off the coast of Honolulu and announced that since there had been some instability and there seemed to be a change of government, the Marines were going to land to protect the new regime and the lives and property of all Hawaiians. So that meant that there was nothing the Queen could do. The regime was immediately recognized by the United States. And with that simple process, the monarchy of Hawaii came to an end, and then ultimately Hawaii joined the U.S.
The Queen called in ambassadors from other countries for help?
The Queen was a little bit shocked by all of this, as were her cabinet ministers. In fact, they appealed to the United States and asked, "What instability is there? Who's in danger? Tell us, and we'll protect them." The Queen had about 600 troops at her disposal. That was the whole Hawaiian military force. And her cabinet ministers actually called the ambassadors from foreign countries in Honolulu, there were about a dozen of them then, and said, "What should we do? You think we should fight the Marines?" And the ambassadors quite prudently told her that that would be foolish. You should just accept it and then try to regain your throne by some other means. That never proved possible. But even then, it was clear to the ruler of this small, weak country that there was no hope in resisting U.S. military intervention.
It still took a few years before Hawaii was ultimately annexed.
It's a very interesting story. Immediately after the revolution, the revolutionaries went back to Washington, and sure enough, President Harrison, as he promised, submitted to the U.S. Congress a law to bring Hawaii into the U.S. But there was a great resistance to this when it was understood how the coup was organized and on whose behalf it was organized. So the Congress did not immediately approve the annexation of Hawaii, and right at that time the presidency changed. The Republican, Benjamin Harrison, was out of office, and the new president, a Democrat, Grover Cleveland, came in. He was against annexation. He was an anti-imperialist. He withdrew the treaty, and that meant that Hawaii had to become an independent country for a few years until the next Republican president came into office, McKinley. And then at the height of the Spanish-American War, when the U.S. was taking the Philippines, Hawaii was presented to the U.S. as a vital midway station between California and the Philippines. And it was at that time, 5 years after the revolution, that Hawaii was actually brought into the United States.
We're talking to Stephen Kintzer. So first came the missionaries, then came the Marines.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes we hear the phrase, business follows the flag. But in my research, I found that it's actually the opposite. First comes the business operations, then comes the flag. It's the flag that follows business.
We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back to this discussion about, well, the title of his book is Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Stay with us.
China, 1945 to 46, 50 to 53. Korea, 50 to 53. Guatemala, 54, 60, 67 to 69. Indonesia, 1958. Cuba, 59 to 60.
April 21 today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Chicago, where Stephen Kinzer is based, longtime foreign correspondent for The New York Times, author of a number of books, including All the Shah's Men, about Iran, Bitter Fruit, about Guatemala. His latest is Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. He just recently left The New York Times. You talk about 14 countries that the U.S. intervened in: Hawaii, Cuba, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Chile, Honduras, Iran, Guatemala, South Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Panama. Let's talk about Cuba. What happened?
The Cuban story is really a fascinating one, partly because it illustrates one of the main themes of my book, and that is how these interventions, in the long run, always produce reactions and ultimately lead to the emergence of regimes that are much more anti-American than the regimes we originally set out to overthrow. Here was the story in Cuba. Americans had had their eye on Cuba for a long time, ever since Thomas Jefferson was president. But it was in 1898 that this attachment to the cause of Cuba Libre really seized the hearts of many Americans. Bear in mind that in 1898, the Cuban economy was totally dominated by Americans. It was a big sugar producer, and all the sugar plantations in Cuba were owned by Americans. Also, it was a very big market for American manufactured goods. About 85% of anything you could buy in Cuba had been made in the United States. So American business had very big interest there. Now, Cuban patriots spent much of the late 19th century rebelling against Spanish colonial rule. In 1898, they seemed very close to succeeding. This was a little bit troubling to some of the American interests in Cuba because the revolutionaries were also social reformers. They advocated land reform, which would have meant breaking up the big sugar plantations owned by Americans. They also supported a tariff wall around Cuba to allow the growth of domestic manufacturing, which would have made it more difficult for American companies to export their goods to Cuba.
And what year was this?
These are in the late 1890s. So in 1898... the American press, in some ways excited by whisperings from American businessmen active in Cuba, began a campaign to portray Spanish colonial rule in Cuba as the most unspeakably brutal tyranny that could be imagined. And the American public was whipped up into a fervor about this. The fervor intensified when the U.S. battleship Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor. Our warship was blown up by an enemy's infernal machine. That was the headline in the New York Journal that I reproduce in my book. Actually, it wasn't until 75 years later that the Navy convened a board of inquiry, which turned up the fact that the Maine was actually blown up by an internal explosion. The Spanish had nothing to do with it. But we didn't know that then. And the press seized on this to intensify the anger in the U.S. Now, the Americans then decided we would send troops to Cuba to help the patriots overthrow Spanish colonialism. But the Cuban revolutionaries were not so sure they liked this idea. They didn't know if they wanted thousands of American troops on their soil, because what would happen after the victory was won? In response to this concern, the U.S. government, the Congress, passed a law, the Teller Amendment, which said very explicitly, we promise Cuba that the moment independence is won, all American troops will be withdrawn and Cuba will be allowed to become fully independent. After that law was passed, the Cuban rebels agreed to accept American aid. American soldiers went to Cuba, including famously Teddy Roosevelt, who had his own uniform personally designed for him by Brooks Brothers in New York. In the space of essentially one day of fighting, the Spanish colonial rule was dealt its final death blow. Spain surrendered Cuba, and Cuba prepared for a huge celebration of its independence. Just before that celebration was about to be held, the Americans announced that they changed their mind, that the Teller Amendment had been passed in a moment of irrational enthusiasm, and that actually Cuban independence was not a very good idea, so the American troops were not withdrawn. We remained in Cuba for some decades, ruling it directly under U.S. military officers, and then for a period after that, through local dictators. Now, flash forward to 1959. That was when Fidel Castro's revolution succeeded. Castro came down from the hills and made his very first speech as leader of the revolution in Santiago. And in that speech, which I quote in my book, he does not talk about what kind of a regime he's going to impose, but he makes one promise. He says, "This time, I promise you, it will not be like 1898 again, when the Americans came in and made themselves masters of our country." Now, any Americans who might have read a report of that speech, I'm sure, would have been very puzzled. In the first place, they would have had no memory of what happened in 1898. But secondly, they would wonder, what could an event 60 years ago possibly have to do with this revolution in Cuba today? What they fail to realize is that resentment over these interventions burns in the hearts and souls of people in foreign countries and later explodes violently. It's quite reasonable to say today that had we not intervened in Cuba and prevented Cuba from becoming independent, had we carried out our explicit promise to the Cubans in 1898, we would never have had to face the entire phenomenon of Cuba, of Castro communism, all these last 40 years. Now, of course, we would love to have the back a moderate democratic regime like the one that was going to come to power in Cuba in 1898, but it's too late for that. And it's an example of how when we frustrate people's legitimate nationalist aspirations, we wind up not only casting those countries into instability, but severely undermining our own national security.
Now, something we see today, for example, in Iraq, is the critical role not only of the U.S. government, perhaps protecting U.S. corporations, but the role of the media in all of this. Going back to Cuba, what was the role of the media?
The press played a really shameful role in the run-up to the Spanish-American War. The Americans had never been particularly fond of the Spanish rule in Cuba, but it wasn't until the press, in a circulation war, decided to seize on the brutality, as they called it, of Spanish colonial rule in the summer of 1898, that Americans really went crazy. Now, there's one very interesting aspect of the Cuban press campaign that I think we see repeated periodically throughout American history, and that is, we never like to attack simply a regime. We like to have one individual. Americans love to have a demon, a certain person who is the symbol of all the evil and tyranny in the regime that we want to attack. We've had this with Khomeini, with Castro, with Gaddafi, various other figures over history. Now, in the case of the Spanish-American War, we first thought we'd like to demonize the King of Spain, but there was no King of Spain. There was a queen who was actually an Austrian princess, so she wouldn't work. The regent, her son, was actually just a 12-year-old kid, so he wouldn't work either. So then we decided to focus on the Spanish general who was the commander of Spanish troops in Cuba, General Weyler. And for a time, Weyler was thought of as the epitome of all the carnal brutality that we attributed to Spanish colonialism. We see this pattern again coming right up to the modern age when we're always looking for some individual to point at. The idea behind this is that the natural state of all people in the world is to have U.S.-style democracy and to be friendly to the United States. If they're not, it must mean that there's only one person or one tiny clique that is preventing the people in this country from being the way they naturally would be. And if we could only just remove this one individual or this tiny clique, the people in that country would return to the normal state of all people, which is to wish to have the U.S. system of government and politics and economics and to embrace the United States.
William Randolph Hearst, was he a key figure then?
Hearst was a crucial figure who very cleverly realized that he could push the circulation of his newspaper dramatically higher if he hammered away on jingoistic issues by pointing at foreign nations as constantly seeking to undermine the United States. There's a undercurrent, which we're still seeing today, of seeing the world in this very Hobbesian way, that there are terrible dangers everywhere, and it's very important for the U.S. to go out and attack here and attack there before those dangers come to shore. Clausewitz, who I read a lot while I was researching my book, had a great phrase for this. He called it suicide for fear of death. You're so afraid of what's happening to you in the world or what might happen to you that you go out and launch operations which actually produce the result that you were afraid might happen if you didn't do these things.
Can you talk about John Foster Dulles, who he was, his role in these interventions, Guatemala, and just before that, Iran?
One of the things I do in my book that I haven't done in my previous books is focus a lot on Dulles. I really believe that Dulles was one of the key figures in shaping the second half of the 20th century. And I devote some time to try to analyze him and figure out why he played this role. First of all, Dulles spent almost all of his adult life as America's most successful and most highly paid corporate lawyer. He represented all of the giant multinational corporations in America, not just United Fruit, but International Nickel and all sorts of resource conglomerates all over the world. So the whole way he saw the world was economics. He thought that American policy in the world should be oriented towards protecting American corporations. Dulles also came from a family of clergymen. He was a deep religious believer. His father was a preacher. His grandfather had been a missionary in India. And this gave him another strain, which is very important in the American regime change era, and that is this sense of religious mission, this belief that since the United States has been blessed with prosperity and democracy, we have not just the right, but perhaps even the God-given obligation to go to other countries and share the benefits of all we have with them, particularly to countries that may not even be advanced enough to realize how much they want our political system. So Dulles saw the world in a strictly black and white way. He saw at that time the communist conspiracy all over the world as working relentlessly to undermine the United States. For example, he opposed all cultural exchanges with any communist country. He tried for years to keep U.S. reporters from visiting China. He was against summit meetings of all kinds. He didn't want agreement with communist countries on any subject because he thought any agreement would be just a trick to get America to lower its guard. Now, when Iran nationalized its oil industry, when Guatemala tried to restrict the operations of United Fruit Company, Dulles did not see this as a reflection of a desire by people in a foreign country to control their own resources. He rather saw it as an anti-American move, undoubtedly manipulated from the Kremlin, which had a much more profound goal than simply bothering an American company. This was just the beginnings of an anti-American attack. Now, one of the things I ask in my book is, why did we so tragically misjudge nationalist movements in developing countries like Iran and Guatemala and later Chile? Why did we interpret them as part of an international conspiracy, which, as documents later proved, they were not? I think it was for this reason. American statesmen and diplomats who study the history of diplomacy are actually studying the history of European diplomacy. We're very Eurocentric. So our diplomats and our statesmen are very well versed in European political traditions. They're familiar with alliance politics and wars of conquest and big powers that use small powers secretly for their own means. But the desire of poor people in poor countries to control their own natural resources has never been a part of European history. It's not a syndrome that Americans who study Europe are familiar with. And that, along with an instinctive desire to protect American companies, I think led them to misjudge nationalist movements and misinterpret them as part of a global conspiracy to undermine the United States.
Or perhaps not care, but care about U.S. companies, as in Guatemala, United Fruit, being able to have free reign.
I think it was very much a sense that the companies must know what's best for the United States in those countries. But in addition, we managed to persuade ourselves that a government that was bothering American companies must also be harassing and oppressing its own people. And this is an argument that I think is very well tailored to the American soul. You know, we really are a very compassionate people. And Americans hate the idea that there are people suffering in some faraway country. American leaders who want to intervene in those countries for very ignoble reasons understand this, and they use that motive. They play on the American compassion to achieve support for their interventions.
So talk about what fuels Iran today, the feeling Iranians have for America based on the coup the U.S. was involved with in 1953.
It's hard to believe today that we could even use the word Iran and democracy in the same sentence. But the fact is, Iran was a functioning, thriving democracy in the late 40s and early 50s. Because Iran nationalized its oil industry rather than allow it to continue being exploited by foreigners, Iran became a target for foreign intervention. And the U.S. did overthrow the democracy of Iran in the summer of 1953. We placed on the throne the Shah. He ruled for 25 years with increasing repression. His repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, the Islamic Revolution. That revolution brought to power a fanatically anti-American clique of mullahs who began their regime by taking American diplomats as hostage, has then spent 25 years oppressing its own people and doing whatever it could, sometimes very violently, to undermine American interests in the world. And that is the regime with which we are now approaching a very serious world crisis regarding the nuclear issue. Now, had we not intervened in 1953 and crushed Iranian democracy, we might have had a thriving democracy in the heart of the Muslim Middle East all these 50 years. I can hardly wrap my mind around how different the Middle East might be now. This regime that's now in power in Iran would never have come to power, and the current nuclear crisis would never have emerged. This is a great example of how our intervention ultimately leads us to regimes much worse than the ones we originally set out to overthrow. Now, how do you think that people in Iran react when Americans point a finger at them and say, you're a tyranny over there, you're a brutal dictatorship, you should have a democracy, you should have a free regime? Well, they say, we had a democracy here until you came in and overthrew it. Now, the United States today has some very legitimate complaints against the Iranian government. But we have to understand that Iranians also have some very legitimate complaints against us. And that should be a recognition that would lead us into negotiations with them at this point.
Stephen Kinzer, we're going to have to leave it there for today. But next week, part two of this discussion on overthrow, America's century of regime change from Hawaii to Iraq, looking at 14 coups of the last more than a century that the U.S. was involved with. That does it for today's broadcast from Chicago. Tomorrow, I will be in Portland, Oregon, as we celebrate KABU, Community Radio, and the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Maddie Harper, Yoruba Richin, Nick Marsilio, and Mike DeFilippo, our engineers. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Megan Whitney, and I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.